welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, December 5th, 2016. Women in Imatong State talk to men about the crimes they commit against women, including rape. And a top South Sudanese official denies South Africa's leader tried to bring President Kiir and Riek Machar together in his country. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Women's rights activists in Imatong State say they are using this year's 16 days of activism against gender-based violence to talk directly to men about the widespread criminal activity in South Sudan. They're also using the 16 days to advocate for more women to be appointed to local government positions where they can influence decisions and policies. Women's rights activists in Imatong State say the vast majority of cases of gender-based violence, including gang rapes, are carried out by men. They say the men who commit these acts of violence against women and girls often get away scot-free because men dominate decision-making positions and men do not arrest other men committing the crimes. They say that's not going to change anytime soon unless many more women are appointed chiefs, county commissioners, and directors in government ministries in order to influence important decisions and policies affecting women's lives. Imatong activist and state lawmaker Angelo Chiro says in Imatong State and many other parts of South Sudan, gender-based problems are rooted in the culture of the people. Achiro says most women employed in the military and police unit are only offered jobs as office cleaners, tea makers, and messengers, while men who are not even educated are appointed to better positions. She says if a woman were head of the army, she would enforce the law and prevent government soldiers and rebel forces from raping women. Davidica Akai, who heads an organization called Itswak, which means morning star in the local Lotuko language, says having women in high positions at the local and state level will ensure that girls not only are enrolled in school, but stay in school. Akai believes only through educating girls can gender-based violence in South Sudan be reduced. Mary Cummins, head of the United Nations Mission in South Sudan office, says addressing the widespread problems of violence against women in South Sudan will be a long and tedious process, but she urges women not to give up hope. Josephine Kanduri, who works in the Department of Gender at the UN Mission in South Sudan, says Imatong State has some of the highest recorded cases of rape in the country. She says her office and a health charity called Health Link recorded an average of 30 rape cases per month this year, and those are only the ones that are reported. Kanduri says many South Sudanese women do not report rape cases because they do not want to be stigmatized by their communities. Jacob Atari, Imatong State Education, Gender and Social Welfare Minister, says clearly most gender-based cases of violence are perpetuated by men, but she says attitudes can and must change. Dimo Silva Arello prepared that report from Torit. The director of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, based here in Washington's National Defense University, says the only way to save South Sudan's sovereignty and restore its legitimacy is to establish an international transitional administration established by the United Nations and the African Union. Kate Almquist-Knopf, who heads the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says the fighting that has continued in South Sudan for the past 3 years has torn apart communities, triggered inflation rates up to nearly 600%, and caused a humanitarian crisis that's left some 3.6 million people facing severe food shortages.
And for all of these reasons, I've laid out an argument that suggests that we need to provide a level of what I call life support for the people of South Sudan, for the state of South Sudan, whereby they borrow both capacity and legitimacy from the international community for a finite period of time to help restore a level of stability and security and just basic humanitarian conditions for the people of South Sudan to then decide what kind of government and what kind of state they want going forward to reclaim their own agency over their country.
Naf argues that the only way to pull South Sudan out of its deep crisis is to usher in a United Nations and African Union established international transitional administration that would last for 10 to 15 years. She says full executive authority would be vested in the international administration, and it would have the power to appoint and remove ministers, state governors, and other officials. The administration would also be able to vet laws and legislation. Naf says the Kiir administration has failed to provide its citizens with basic security. She says although the proposal is a radical idea, it could be the first step toward protecting the country's people.
I think it would be important for the international community to find a way for South Sudanese to express their interest in that and to ask for that kind of assistance. I think that would require necessarily negotiating some of the current leadership to remove themselves from the political process of South Sudan.
Naf says an international transitional administration would depend on the willingness of both Mr. Kiir and Riek Machar to abdicate their power to the AU and the UN. She says both men would also have to agree to leave the country and never participate in South Sudanese politics. Naf says the international community could negotiate the two leaders out of power by offering them immunity from possible indictments and prosecutions of war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court. She says both would be offered a safe haven abroad if they agree to permanently stay out of South Sudan and abstain from taking part in any political process in the country. To maintain inclusivity, Naf says the transitional administration would include an advisory council made up of representatives from the SPLM in government, as well as the SPLM in opposition. She adds that the transitional administration would have the final say on expenditures, annual budgets, and procurement, and oil revenues would be managed by the World Bank through an international escrow account. Naf argues that a transitional administration is cost-effective and would not cost the more than $11 billion the U.S. has spent since 2005. She says 10 to 15-year period time could allow institutions to be built and for South Sudanese to regain their confidence. Gordon Bwai, South Sudan's ambassador for diaspora affairs to North America, dispels the notion that such a form of government could work in South Sudan, equating it to colonialism.
She said that South Sudan should be ruled by the UN because we have no functioning judiciary. That is not true. We have functioning judiciary. If you go to most states, we have functioning judiciary in those states. Only the areas where there's war is where there is no justice system. In South Sudan, we have a Supreme Court. So this would not be a justification for an independent country, which is a member of the UN, to be ruled or to be colonized by the UN for 10 years, as he suggested.
A top South Sudan government official is denying unconfirmed reports that South Africa's president tried to arrange a meeting between President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar. President Kiir has just wrapped up a visit to South Africa, where Mr. Machar has been living since leaving South Sudan and other East African countries. A report in the Sudan Tribune newspaper says both Mr. Kiir and Machar declined a proposal by South African President Jacob Zuma to bring the two together as a confidence-building gesture. Ezekiel Lol Gutkwath, South Sudan's petroleum minister who joined President Kiir's delegation to South Africa, tells VOA's James Buddy that the two presidents discussed how South Africa can help Mr. Kiir implement the 2015 peace deal.
His Excellency General Salva Kiir Mayardi, the President of the Republic of South Sudan, was invited by His Excellency President Jacob Zuma. He went there on a state visit to have bilateral discussions between South Africa and South Sudan. It has nothing to do with Dr. Machar. Dr. Machar is in South Africa. It was not discussed at all, or it was not brought up by President Zuma that His Excellency General Salva Kiir Mayardi, the President of the Republic, should meet Dr. Machar.
The article here is quoting a South Sudan presidential aide who said, quote, "We were expecting South African government and the ANC leadership to arrange a special meeting between President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar." As you said, President Salva Kiir is still in South Africa. Is this something that is expected, that he's looking forward to meet with Riek Machar while he's there?
I was in South Africa with him. He was actually discussing bilateral issues, what they have discussed is the implementation of the agreement in South Sudan and how South Africa can help His Excellency President Salva Kiir to implement the agreement and to consolidate peace in the country, reconcile the people of South Sudan, unite them, making sure that the Republic of South Sudan is prosperous, the economy of the country can grow, and how South Africa can help South Sudan to make sure that South Sudan is supported in the implementation of the agreement and also in the developmental projects. There is nothing that was discussed about Dr. Machar.
But Ezekiel, you have mentioned in the article saying this so-called presidential aide who has been quoted, that the Minister of Petroleum, Ezekiel Logdiakov, went with us to South Africa now because of the understanding that he will play a role in the meeting of President Kiir and Riek Machar. The assumption is that because you were there in South Africa with Riek Machar before.
Why would somebody be quoted? If it is me to coordinate this, then I should be the one to be quoted. And why is that person hiding? These are the people who are sympathetic to Dr. Machar. They wanted to just get attention. When we were in South Africa, on the 1st of December, he decided to appoint fake appointments. The deputy chairman of the SPLM in opposition, the secretary general of the SPLM in opposition. These are people, one is in Canada, one is in UNMISS camp, and himself, Dr. Machar, is in South Africa, and he cannot even come to the region. So this is actually another attempt to create a diversion from the implementation of the agreement. We are basically calling everybody that we have to say enough is enough. War is not acceptable. We want to make sure that peace is implemented. It is being implemented. President Salva Kiir and First Vice President General Thabang Dengai, they are working as a team. They are implementing the agreement. The Transitional Government of National Unity is functioning. It is working. It has been formed. The Transitional National Legislative Assembly in the Parliament is formed. The state's government will be formed soon. Civil servants are reinstated. And we are moving. You can see the harmony and peace in South Sudan.
That was VOA's James Buddy speaking to Ezekiel Logdiakov, South Sudan's petroleum minister, from Juba yesterday. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. What are South Sudanese doing to find clean water in a Ugandan refugee camp? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you think Africa should become one big country? Why or why not?
I don't think Africa should become one big country because I think smaller countries is easier to govern and to rule.
No, it is impossible. Because now, even in a one state, you would find that it is very difficult for the leaders to manage the one country. So if the whole continent became a one state, it would be impossible for them to manage or to lead it.
If it's going to be headed by one political leader and there's going to be free border and people can move from one place to another easily, I think it's going to be good. It's going to foster investment.
No, I don't think Africa should become one big country. We are too diverse in our culture and way of thinking, and one big country will create chaos.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. People living with disabilities in Sudan are calling on the government to protect their rights and include their concerns when planning development programs. The call was made today during an event organized to mark the United Nations International Day of Persons with Disabilities. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Khartoum.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and a group called Action on Disability and Development International, or ADD, organized the event in Khartoum, which is aimed at reaching the 2020 UN Sustainable Development Goals of No One Left Behind. Nahed Khairi is a visually impaired woman who represents disabled people in Sudan's National Assembly. Speaking in Arabic, she says, efforts to recognize the needs of disabled people in Sudan have come a long way with the help of their USAID and ADD partners.
There is an awakening. at least in Khartoum, and that society is aware of the existence of disabled people who are part of the community, people who are unfortunate enough to have a disability, but at the same time quite capable of taking charge of their cause.
Mohamed Magzoub is the ADD International's country director for Sudan. He says the revised UN Sustainable Development Goals highlight the importance of inclusion.
Previously, under the Millennium Development Goals, persons with disabilities were left behind. They were less likely to receive the health care, less likely to get an education, less likely to be employed, and they faced particular risks in emergency situations. The Sustainable Development Goals make clear that this has to change.
Magzoub says his group worked with the European Union to roll out a very successful project that helps women with disabilities in Gadarif, Kassala, and the Red Sea states in eastern Sudan.
The project achieved significant results at all levels, from the self-confidence of individual women to the actions of ministries. The project also supported some women with disabilities to undertake new income-generating activities, contributing to their local economies and to reduction of poverty. And the project saw the election of two women to state and national legislative councils.
The UN estimates that 80% of the estimated 1 billion people living with disabilities around the world are found in developing countries like Sudan. The UN also estimates that 5% of Sudan's 30 million people live with disabilities, and the majority of them are children. USAID's Deputy Country Director Lee Swanson says the US government is committed to supporting disabled people in Sudan.
We have legal, social, and economic reasons to include people with disabilities into all our programming. Excluding persons with disabilities results in economic losses for our country and for the global economy.
USAID is leading a program called Enhancing Inclusion and Participation of People with Disabilities in Sudan. Swanson says the program is active in the five states of Blue Nile, Kassala, Gadarif, South Kordofan, and Khartoum.
Already that program has achieved significant, or made significant progress, if you like, in raising awareness in the policy arena, securing access to healthcare in one state, and securing access to assistive devices and services.
Swanson says, in the private sector, USAID has worked with the Bank of Khartoum to launch automatic teller machines, or ATMs, designed to suit the needs of blind Sudanese citizens. Sudan is a signatory to the International Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Khairi says much more needs to be done on the part of the government of Sudan to put plans into action that benefit Sudanese people with disabilities. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biaju.
South Sudanese refugees at the Bidibidi camp in Uganda's Yumbe district say they face huge challenges getting water for their daily needs. And that struggle for water, refugees say, has become a source of conflict in the settlement, especially among women. Simon Peter Apiku has the details for VOA from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Ugandan authorities and the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, did not anticipate the difficulty they would have drilling for water in Bidibidi when they decided to settle refugees on this vast expanse of land. Bidibidi occupies an area of about 240 square kilometers and is now the largest refugee settlement in Uganda, hosting some 250,000 South Sudanese refugees. The scale of the problem has become larger as more refugees arrive and the demand for water increases. The UN Refugee Agency first tried to drill boreholes and later hired trucks to bring water from distant water treating plants. But refugees say both attempts have done little to improve the water situation in the camp because Bidibidi sits on land with little to no groundwater. Refugee Rose Sande Khamis arrived this camp in July.
We are having borehole there, and the borehole really, it's very hard to pump. And the water really, it's very few inside there.
UNHCR workers have distributed jerrycans to refugees to collect and store water. Khamis says the difficulty of pumping the water and the number of containers each family wants to fill up creates long queues at boreholes. She says it's not unusual for women to spend nearly half a day in search of water.
Because to wait for one jerrycan, something like maybe 2 hours for you to get one full of jerrycan.
Joshka Kasara, head of a family of eight, resides on a block in the settlement that has a 10,000-liter tank to accommodate 600 people. But Kasara says people in her block experience the same difficulties as those using boreholes. She says the truck comes once a day and at unusual times. She says those who come to the water point early end up collecting all the water for the entire day.
If you fail to get it, then you will suffer. If that water gets finished, you cannot get another one.
Mary Iba gets her water from a tank in her block. She says with enough jerrycans, women can collect enough water to take care of most of the needs of their families. But she adds, since nobody has enough containers, some women steal from others, which leads to fist fights that can result in communal tensions.
Sometimes they saw to fight because of the one the other wants to fetch in front of the other.
Khamis says the water scarcity also makes it hard for refugees to construct mud houses, which they need to replace makeshift plastic sheeting that the UNHCR provides.
Some of them are waiting for the wet season to come first because per now there is no water, congestion in the water point, so to get water really it's very hard.
Moses Ali Mutumba drives one of the trucks hired by the UNHCR to distribute water in the camp. Mutumba says he knows many people living in the camp don't get enough water, but he says it is almost impossible to deliver more than a truckload of water at the same location each day.
You can take the first trip in the morning at around 7. When you come back for the second trip, you find like 5 trucks which are going to work to load the water, which means you should wait for those trucks to load water, and each truck is taking a full hour and a half. Before.
Charlie Yaxley, the spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency in Uganda, admits delivering water to the refugees at Bidi Bidi camp remains an enormous challenge.
The land in Bidi Bidi is quite rocky, and there weren't many boreholes, these wells that go deep underground and provide water. Not many workable ones have been in place. Which means we're forced to resort to delivering water by truck. Now, delivering water by truck is prohibitively expensive and unsustainable. Some of the water that's being delivered to refugees right now is being collected from a water treatment plant almost 50 kilometers away.
The UNHCR says it has no plans to move the refugees to another location, but the UN agency is trying to work with the government of Uganda to resolve the ongoing water problem in the Bidi Bidi settlement. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Apiku in Yumbe District, Uganda.
South Sudanese communities represented in the diaspora have openly exchanged insults on social media following fighting that erupted in late 2013. John Tanza, host of South Sudan in Focus, continues his conversation with Nyamun Mashar and Kwer Garang.
Let me shift the gears here a little bit and say that the advantage that we have here in the West is doing more harm than good. That's what a lot of people are saying. We are not using it for the right purpose. Do you agree with that notion, Nyamun?
I do agree with that notion, because I think when we move to Western and more superpower nations, that culture really begins to taint us. And we start to take on these characteristics of people that are not us. And it reads in the way that we carry ourselves. It reads in the ways that we speak out for our country. Even in the hate speeches, when you think about some of it, it has such an American, like especially for the ones from here, there's such a bullying force. And when I think about just the United States and some of the ways that, they behave to foreign policies and that really aggressive bullying kind of thing. That's how I see a lot of the people behaving. So I think that a lot of them, because we are a product of the place, of the environments that we're in, if we don't decide consciously to hold tight to our culture and behave in that way, we don't need, I don't think that these platforms are anything. I don't think that, we're deserving of it.
Quite, Garang, do you agree with Nyamun?
I agree, because we have a lot to offer, but we are not doing anything to offer it. The main problem is this culture that is becoming prevalent, especially in the Western media, where people focus on the negative. So, for example, in Calgary, where I live, if there's something that is happening in the community, something that is good, and we call the media to come and cover it, they don't. But if there's something happening that is negative, for example, if there's a child who is killed or a child who is found with drugs, then they will come to the community. So that becomes an image of the community. That culture has been adopted by some South Sudanese or many of South Sudanese on social media. If someone posts a video that is really good, that is, you know, empowering, that is trying to call for inclusion, people don't focus on it because it's not interesting. But when someone posts something that is hateful, then people from that given tribe will try to hail the message, will try to be proud of that message, and it's a negative message. So what we need to do is to focus on the positive. It doesn't mean that we don't have positive things happening on social media. There are so many positive things, but we try to ignore them because they're not interesting. And also, they try to call for inclusion, and some people see it as boring. It's not something that people enjoy on social media. So when people post things that are negative, and other tribes see someone as a hero. And a case in point is the case of the Dinkas being killed in Equatoria now on the roads. So when I posted a video calling on, you know, on peace and people to be together, it was not received well by many people because they wanted retaliation. And if someone posted a message about retaliation, that's what they go for. That these are the heroes, these are brave people. And I was being called a coward because I was calling for peace and togetherness. So what we need to do to amplify voices that actually do good doesn't mean there's no good. But what we are doing now, we are doing more harm. And that's a culture that we need to move away from. But how do we move away from that? We cannot move away from that because an individual like Kwira Garang or Nyamun is saying one thing. It has to be a collective effort by the community. Amplify, you know, good messages and try to maybe criticize the negative messages and try to downplay them. And I think we can do good in the social media.
When I look at the South Sudanese society, I mean, I can speak for myself. Where I grew up, traditional leaders, traditional authorities played a greater role in our upbringing, meaning you're not only disciplined by your father, you are disciplined by anybody who is older than you in the community. And that is how we were always, you know, guarding against bad behavior, so to speak, because the person next to you who is older than you will always discipline you. Now, if we bring that into the context of hate speech, do we have traditional authorities that we fear in the diaspora here that could correct us or stop us from posting bad messages or hate speech? Let me use the word hate speech. Nyamun, I can start with you.
Sure. To be honest, no. And I think that it's together. I feel like in some isolated events, there's probably an elder, and granted that young person still holds their culture as a treasure. But for everybody else, I keep talking about it's this taintedness of a culture that does not have, that respect has been thrown out. Everybody feels like this entitlement. Yes, that's what I can call it. It's an entitlement that it was never fought for.
We've been listening to Nyamun Mashar and Kwir Garang, two members of the diaspora, with their take on hate speech among South Sudanese. Tomorrow we ask South Sudanese why they are engaged in hate speech. And that's our show. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.